A little playful music to get us started this afternoon, as play is our topic. We heard Oscar Peterson's Children's Tune. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. In the quest to raise children to be achievers and super achievers, we may be missing the need children have for spontaneous, imaginative play. Tufts University Professor of Child Development David Elkind says lack of play stunts children's emotional, behavioral, and intellectual growth. Further, he says, quoting here, silencing children's play is as harmful to healthy development, if not more so, as hurrying them to grow up too fast, too soon. David Elkind is the author most recently of The Power of Play, How Spontaneous, Imaginative Activities Lead to Happier, Healthier Children. And he is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. David Elkind is professor of child development at Tufts University, the author of more than one dozen books. He's recognized as one of the leading advocates for preserving childhood. His books include The Hurried Child, Ties That Stress, and All Grown Up and No Place to Go. His new book, The Power of Play, is published by DeCapo Press. Dr. Elkind, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. In the introduction to this book, you say that over the last couple of decades, children have lost 12 hours of free time a week, including 8 hours of unstructured play and outdoor activities. So what has supplanted that playtime?
Well, I think, unfortunately, childhood has moved indoors, and so watching television, playing computer games, that sort of thing has really replaced much of the outdoor play. Bike riding is way down, as well as other activities. Even walking to school is down. So I think that, unfortunately, children are playing in more organized activities and more. They're doing more just passive watching than was true in the past.
Yeah. Are they doing more solitary play?
I don't know. It's not clear. Certainly, to the extent that kids are playing computer games, it's more solitary, although some kids do play computer games together, and so there are some, you know, there's a lot of computer games that do invite kids to play together. But certainly, as I see kids around, even in restaurants or on planes or something, they're playing little handheld computer games by themselves.
We have a listener already waiting to talk with you. So let's go and take this call. A listener on a cell phone in the Chicago area on line 4. Hi. Is there a caller there on line 4? No, maybe they'll call back. This is the Afternoon Magazine. David Elkind, our guest this afternoon. We're talking about play. David Elkind, the author most recently of The Power of Play. Something else that you note early in the book is that kids are now seen as a market. They're regarded as consumers. When and how did that begin?
Well, it happened, again, in the 70s, really, I think, with Atari. Up until that time, manufacturers, toy manufacturers and clothing manufacturers, food manufacturers, looked to parents, and because they knew the parents were the ones who purchased toys and purchased games and so on, and they wanted to have toys which reflected parental values, so they looked to parents. With Atari and also the changes in the family, the single parenting and two parent working and so on, what they found was that parents would buy games for their children that they themselves did not approve of, and that was kind of an epiphany for the whole industry. And since then, they have looked to children rather than to parents to sell products, and therefore they spend many toy manufacturers spend more money on research in child development than we in the science of child development. Children are seen as a market, and unfortunately, whereas many of the images of children in the past as innocent or as born with original sin and so on may have been misguided, but they came out of a genuine concern for children, I think the idea of child as a consumer comes out of a sort of commercial greed kind of concern, and not of a concern for children. So we're selling children a lot of things which are not healthy, including overly fatted, sugared foods, and so on. Clothing, which may be inappropriate. Many mothers of 8-year-old tell me they cannot buy clothing for their 8-year-old girls that they without a bare midriff and pants hanging down and so on. So there's a lot of fad toys that are being sold just for the purpose of selling it And there's a consumer net where you have not only a character like Shrek, but you have a Shrek lunchbox, and you have a Shrek bathing suit, and a Shrek, you know, what have you. And so there's a whole sense of salesmanship that go along with it. And whereas character toys like Shrek used to be, you know, Abe Lincoln or Florence Nightingale that had reflected certain values, now they really, even like Barbie, they and more often they're more likely to induce name brand you know, attachments and consumerism than they are to teach values. So I think it's very unfortunate, and there's many organizations now, you know, they're trying to combat this, which is really very, very harmful to children. This generation of children may be the first generation who are less healthy than their parents, because too many children are sitting in front of television, eating junk food, and that, you know, we have 20% of our kids who are obese, and they're on measures of health, strength, endurance, all those things. Their children are doing less well. So it's a very serious issue, I think, not just for, you know, individual parents and children, but for the nation as a whole, because we are, you know, it's a very global economy. We have to be competitive, and we are not being competitive. Play not only helps children physically, but it also helps them mentally. It nourishes their creativity. It nourishes their imagination, their fantasy. And when they're not engaged in that kind of play, those abilities, which are like muscles, are go unused and not developed. So, you know, we have to be very concerned about whether or not we can maintain an edge in the competition with other countries if we're not keeping our children well nourished and spent, you know, in healthy bodies and healthy minds.
Yeah. Well, that drive, that competitive drive, also isn't that also playing into this phenomenon as well? You know, I think of parents who are working very hard to do the best for their children, and they're getting all kinds of messages about the need to prepare their children for adulthood. So there are all kinds of activities, structured activities, toys, games, videos, activities that are labeled as enriching.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, a number of a friend of Marilee Jones, the dean of admissions at MIT, has just written a book about how all this pressure is. The kids we're seeing now are overstructured, overprogrammed, less imaginative, less playful, and that it has a long-term consequence, which is unhealthy, and we're seeing it at the college level, university level. So even though these kids may get good grades, they're not well-rounded people, and they don't know how to play, and they're overly, you know. So I think there's a number of people in the admissions field at the college level who are trying to get to parents to recognize this, that this is not a healthy way to be rearing children. So I think that you have to hear it from the other side. I think parents have a misapprehension about what's good for children. The well-rounded children who do know how to play as well as who know study and so on, are the most effective, the most adaptive.
Well, give us a couple of examples of what creative, imaginative play looks like.
Well, play. One of the points I try to make in the book is that play is not a luxury. It's not something that's not a waste of time. It's a basic human drive. It's our need to really adapt the world to ourselves, and we do that in all different kinds of ways. And it's something we can't keep children from playing. They have a need to play, and the only thing we're doing now is eliminating the time and the amount of opportunities they have to play. But they play all of the time. But play is really the answer to the question: how does anything new ever come about? Play is our creative element, and it's always involves, it's not in opposition to work, but it work is our need to adapt to the external world. And so both are necessary, and if we look at creative art, whether it's a Shakespeare or a Picasso or a Mozart, you know, each of those people, you can identify a Mozart, you know, dude, you can identify a Shakespeare play, you can identify a Picasso just by looking at it, but it also speaks to everyone, so it's personal and social. And that's what democracy is all about. It's the personal and the social, and play is the personal, work is the social, and you need both of them. And I think we try to sort of say work is good and play is bad, but when you combine them, you have the best of both possible worlds. And so when you're, play is the child's ability to create new things or to initiate ideas and to have opinions. And when we respect that as parents, respect their and listen to our children and respect their values and their needs, then they're going to like us more, which is that love aspect. Mm-hmm. And they're going to learn more, and the same is true in schools. If in those schools where children are respected, where their input is taken seriously, then they are more respectful of teachers in the school, and they learn better. And the same thing in the workplace. If the worker is respected, if his or her, you know, input is valued and rewarded, that worker is going to certainly like that employer, and he's going to, she's going to do a better job. So when we combine work, love, and play, and with those basic needs, we have the most best outcome. That's what happens with our avocations, whether we love to garden or plant or, what, or paint or whatever. We take something from ourselves, which is the play, personal aspect, something from the external world, which is the work aspect. And we create something new, which can't be reduced either to us or to the world. But I think we sort of need to think of play as more broadly as really a necessary part of our lives, and that combining it with work and combining it with love gives us the best outcome, whether at home, at school, or at the workplace.
Yeah. So we have a trio of things here going. As you, that's the first chapter of the book: play, love, work, an essential trio. It's kind of a triangular.
Well, and but I think it you know, if we think about it, it makes sense. Anything that we really love to do, any of our avocations, comes from ourselves. That's the play aspect, and if we sew or something, and the love aspect is that our really enjoyment of it, and then the end result, you know, the product that we make is the work aspect, because that's for other people as well as for ourselves, and love can attach either to the personal or the social, and needs to. So I think when we, if we look at businesses where just the kind of things I've talked about, where they really respect the employer and employee and reward them and so on, those businesses are the most successful. There was a recent article in Fortune magazine about just those kinds of businesses where workers are treated well. When you treat workers badly, they're not going to like the work. The boss, they're not going to do a good job. I mean, and the same is true in schools, where you have good schools like the Waldorf schools, which respect children and which take them into account and have them write their own textbooks and so on, those kids do wonderfully well, and they illustrate their own textbooks, so they're dealing in the art, but they also learn, and they do their own research. So again, and they love those kids, they can't wait to get to school. So it's, you know, seems to me some kind of basic and something that we really need to reconsider, and not think, put work and play in opposition to one another, but rather in coordination with one another. They most have the most beneficial effects.
It seems like maybe what you're saying here too is also that we should all be playing more.
Exactly. I think that, you know, play has also therapeutic effects, and I talk in the book about the examples of the fact that we have wonderfully good experiences, and then those provide, sort of, we remember bad experiences like assassination of President Kennedy or 9/11, and we remember those dramatically, but we also remember the good experiences, the happy experiences we have, and we call upon those at times of stress. So if we don't have those many experiences, I just spoke to the American Camping Association, and I was so pleased to tell them how many, for many young people, camping, at least the traditional camping, provides those wonderful, happy experiences that you can call on at times of stress when later on. And if you don't have those happy memories, it's hard to call upon them. So, again, we do ourselves an injustice when we don't play. We don't have enough time to have those happy memories. And we lose someone, one of the most helpful things is to remember the happy times we had with that person and the good times we had with them. That's the most, nurturing thing and the most helpful thing we can do. So, play has so many different functions for us that it's, when we limit the time and opportunities children have to engage in it, we really deprive them of important experiences.
Yeah, and we're playing from the outset of our lives. Little tiny babies they're working at mastering the world.
Exactly. A baby drops the rattle out of the crib and discovers gravity. A baby turns everything he or she touches into an object to be banged. They discover that some things make loud noises, some things make soft noises. A child later on plays with a bunch of pebbles and finds if he puts them in a circle, puts them in a square, puts them in a diamond, they all remain the same, and he discovers conservation. So through the play is the way in which we create new learning experiences, and later on children create their own games and their rules, and they learn social respect, and they learn to respect the other child. There's a whole group of things. So one of the things about play is it's the way we create new experiences, and it's from those experiences that we learn a lot of things that can't be learned in any other way. If you're playing a board game with another child, you're watching his or her facial expression, you're listening to the tone of voice, you're looking at their body language, you're learning a lot of sort of social interactions, you're learning strategies and so on that can't be learned in any other way. And you can't learn it on a computer game, and you're not learning it just doing lessons on a plan on a book. So there's so much social learning as well as intellectual learning that goes on through play that when we limit it, we also limit the kinds of learning and the effectiveness of children's learning. And that's what the point I'm trying to make in the book, really.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that children do when they get a little bit older, and they can either invent their own games or they can sit down and play a board game, or they can play a sport like baseball or something. They're doing all kinds of tasks. They might be setting rules or
exactly.
Setting out an objective. They got to choose sides or pick a thing that you're. What kind of piece are you going to move around the board?
Exactly.
And then also, you know, inevitably there's going to be conflict.
Exactly, and then they learn conflict resolution and so on. And so there's so many things that they learn through play that I think to call it as a waste of time or, you know, luxury is really a misrepresentation, and that's really the major point I try to make in the book, that play is a necessary drive, a human drive, and when children play, they learn a lot of things that they can't learn any other way. And when we limit children's play, we deprive them of important learning experiences. And I think that's really the major message I'm trying to make.
Yeah. Do you think as adults we're too quick to schedule, to initiate, and then when there's a little conflict, too quick to step in?
I think so. I think we tend to tend to feel that it's harmful and that children. I think. Basically, I don't think we trust children enough. I think if we allow them, certainly children will come to their own resolutions. It used to be that we just told children to play, go out and play, and they would get into fights, and they would have discussions and so on, but they eventually can resolve them, and they do it in their own way.
Yeah.
They're at their own level of understanding, their own level of communication. They need to do that, and certainly if it's getting way out of hand,
sure.
If kids are really pummeling each other, then certainly you need to step in. But if it's simply an altercation and they're having verbal discussion and then I think that allow them to resolve it. And so I was watching some kids playing a computer game, and they were all sort of taking turns. And the teacher came in and said, no, you have to take turns. Well, they weren't taking turns. They were all working at it together in a very cooperative way. So, again, sometimes we have to watch children and see. Computers are new. We haven't had a lot of experience with them, and children use them in their own ways and can use them creatively and constructively if we give them the opportunity and give them the programs which are helpful and so on. So it's... I think basically we don't trust children enough to be able to handle those kinds of situations, and we need to give them a chance.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's like thinking maybe a little bit like my parents did or the parents of my generation. It was, we'll see you at dinner.
Right, exactly.
Let's talk with a listener. David Elkind is our guest this afternoon, the author most recently of The Power of Play, How Spontaneous Imaginative Activities Lead to Happier, Healthier Children. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Let's talk now with a listener in Kankakee on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
In The Power of Play, the guest indicates that during infancy, play, love, and work are almost indistinguishable. That during the stages of maturation, the disposition to work and then the love disposition become primary. And that during adulthood, the dynamisms of play, love, and work may be reunited into a single integrated activity. Your caller is interested in how the play, love, and work dispositions may play out in the elderly. But his question for the guest relates to the adult union of play, love, and work as flow, the nine elements of which are set forth in a 1996 work, Creativity, published by HarperCollins, which the guest cites and quotes. Could the guest expand on and discuss flow, something he experienced in sailing? Yeah, thank you.
Great question. You've read the, he's read the book.
Yeah, I guess he did. Yeah, the man who introduced the Ideal Flow, and I must confess I have great difficulty pronouncing his name, and so I won't even attempt it, but he's a well-known psychologist, I think, and philosopher at the University of Chicago. But in any case, Flow is really getting it all together. I talked about sailing, that I have a small sailboat, and sometimes when the winds are just right and sails are just right, that everything is sort of perfect. The boat sort of sings. It's heeling at a nice angle, and I feel I'm almost at one with the boat in the water. That's a kind of flow, and everything sort of goes together. And it doesn't happen that often because it's partly chance. You see it with certain athletes or dancers or musicians or so on, when everything, the ability, the instrument, and everything comes together in a sort of perfect way, and sometimes you even have it as a parent. You say the right thing, and the child smiles up at you with a glow, and you have that glow, and it's just that time when everything comes together, the right words, the right feelings, the right response, and it all comes together in this kind of, you know, feeling of joy and effortlessness, and it's just a special kind of feeling, and he talks about really 9 different aspects of it. But and I think it to me it reflects that kind of union of play, love, and work, but it's a very special union when they come together in such a unique way that you everything feels to be almost universal experience, it's rare, but when we experience it, it's extraordinary. And some people experience it outside in a lovely day or something like that. But so it just goes to me to reemphasize the I think Flo talks too about in many ways the union of play, love, and work in a kind of seamless way.
Yeah, some people have also, I think athletes in particular, have talked about being in the zone.
Right. Yeah, it's that kind of idea, the same sort of idea. You're right in there, and it just everything is just moving. You don't think about it. Say you're a musician playing, and you're not thinking about the notes. You're thinking about the music, and you're right there. And I'm sure that sometimes writers, when you're writing, sometimes it just. So I know the Hurry mm-hmm. Child was written in 6 weeks, and it just burst, and other books take me years. So it's that sort of thing, you know. And again, I think reinforces this idea that play, love, and work are when they come together, we have our best products and best outcomes.
Yeah, dancing with life.
Yeah, exactly. Well put.
You know, this caller raised a really interesting question too, as well, that I would like you to talk about, and that is play and people who are older. People who are elderly.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but it seems to me that one of the things we know about aging is that styles persist. The people who are playful in adulthood, then they retain those traits as they get. So people who are very tight will get tighter. People who are very conservative get more conservative. As we get older, mm-hmm. our basic traits tend to get sort of more emphasized, so that people, and I know elderly friends, and I'm getting in there myself, who, you know, always joked, and it seems to stay with them, and they take an attitude. And my brother, who's 90 has always been so interested in people and so on, and that maintains him. He still has tremendous interest in people and always had a huge sense of humor. So I think that if you develop a sense of play and curiosity and sense early on, that's going to stay with you as you age. But if you don't haven't developed that earlier on, it's hard to develop it later. And it's one of the things that Erickson talked about in the last stage of life. He talked about generativity versus stagnation. And then he talked about, you know, integrity versus despair. And he said, you know, the sense of integrity is your life has been well lived. Well, if you enjoyed life and you shared your joy with others, and so on, you're more likely to have a sense of integrity than if you have not had that. If you've had your nose to the grindstone all the time, not had taken the pleasure in your own children as they were growing up, and taken pleasure in doing the things you wanted to do, and always put it off for the last time, and mm-hmm. so on, then you're less likely to have that sense of integrity, and more likely to have the sense of despair. So that's another reason, it seems to me, all the more reason why we should, you know. introduce and make play a major part of our life throughout our lives.
Yeah, because there's lifelong consequences.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, it strikes me thinking about this issue and looking at my my in-laws when they retired. They went back. It's interesting to me that now that I'm thinking about it, they went back to what we talked about a moment ago, only we talked about it in terms of infants, and that is mastery play.
Yeah.
They picked up new things that they wanted to do, that they thought, you know, I kind of would like to try that. And so one picked up sculpting and one painting.
Yeah, I've just taken up pottery. I love it. I've been working on the wheel. I can't wait to spend more time on the wheel. But because I think if you have that kind of orientation, then you know the golden years can really be golden because you can learn new things and you're still learning and you're not, you know, just missing what you didn't do, but rather enjoying the new things that you can do.
Yeah. And for myself, you know, here in middle age, I'm thinking, you know, it's time maybe to take the cell phone and the laptop and shelve it for a while.
Right. Yeah, it can be addictive, and I think we need to make time. I've always played cards with my sons, and that's always been something we still do now, even they're grown. And I do crosswords, and even though it's a kind of play, and it's a kind of fun, and I think it's very important to develop those kinds of habits very early, come play habits, and that you can continue and that you do make sure that you take time to just go out and enjoy the sunshine, enjoy the roses and so on. Life is just very short, and particularly as parents, you know, children grow up so quickly. You look back and, you know, that it's gone. And if you didn't take the time to enjoy those children, those wonderful years, and, you know, when children are so inventive and creative, and to take time to pleasure and enjoy that, and instead are pushing kids into all kinds of activities, you don't see the natural joy and playfulness of childhood. We miss a tremendous amount, but we miss those times when we ourselves can play with our children and the joys that brings. And it's very healthy and has probably does as much for them as any other kind of organized activity or training or whatever. So I think that's the most important thing we can give our children is our own attention, our own interactions. Life goes back very quickly, by very quickly, as I know now as I age. Fortunately, I was fortunate that I did enjoy my children. Now I have a chance to enjoy my grandchildren, and I'm doing that.
Yeah, well, good for you. What would be your advice for making sure that we do spend time together, that we make time for fun, that we have family time?
Well, you know, it is a different world, and it is a competitive world, and we have more single parents and more two parents working and so on, and that's reality, and you have to deal with it. I sometimes think that we sometimes feel if we don't do everything, you know, don't play all the time, stay home all the time, something we can't do anything. And I think the strategy is to do something. You can't do everything, but, you know, Christopher say, write one little candle. So setting a time each week with a family to be together is a kind of sacred time, either for a meal or a game or some activity, I think is one way to do that. Another is to take each child individually on a trip or shopping or for a meal or something, so that you get to know them a little bit and you have a one-to-one time with each child. And so each child, you take turns, each child gets that. Mm-hmm. Whether with either parent or, so there are little things that you can do. It doesn't have to be a lot, but they mean a tremendous amount to the child, mean a tremendous amount to you. And so don't feel that you have to do everything, but realize that you can do something.
David Elkind is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a professor of child development at Tufts University. He is the author most recently of The Power of Play, How Spontaneous, Imaginative Activities Lead to Happier, Healthier Children. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. There's a chapter in the book about that deals a great deal with humor, lighthearted parenting.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I've tried to point out is that when we combine love, work, and play in our parenting, we are most effective. And one way to do that certainly is to use humor and discipline and so on. And I talk about, give an example of my own son. When I sort of got angry at him, he did something, and my wife was a better psychologist than I, sort of counseled me to cool down. And then I remembered Ralph Cramden from The Honeymooners, and he used to say, "To the moon, Alice," and smack his one fist into his palm. And I did it, and I said, "To the moon, Paul." And then I said, "Okay, now let's clean up the mess that happened." And what I think that does is that he knows I'm not going to send him to the moon, but he also knows that I'm angry, and I can get my anger out and express it, because that's healthy, but I'm not attacking him. And I think one of our tendencies, unfortunately, as parents, and we all do it, is to sort of attack the child. "Oh, you're so messy, or you're so sloppy, or you're always forgetting." And we're attacking the child's character. And one of the things about using humor is that we get away from that. "I'll break your arm if you do that." "Well, they know we're not going to break their arm." But it says, "I'm angry," and that's how and it's important to use humor to avoid the personal attack, because the incident itself is a one-time thing, but how we handle it has long-term consequences. If we attack the child's character, that has long-term consequences. In addition, we're giving the child a model of how to handle emotions, our own emotions, and we're also giving them a model for how they themselves would parent. So it has long-term consequences, and I think it's very important for us to, I think this happens at school too. I think I give the example of when I was running a school, and a young man who got very angry at one of the other kids and took up a chair to hit him because he broke his sculpture or something, and I sort of put my arms around him and said, "Shall we dance?" And, just sort of break the... And he wasn't very happy with me, but I said, "You really have to tell him you're angry, and then you have a legitimate reason to be angry, but you cannot hit him, and you cannot hit a chair, throw a chair at him." So a few weeks later, I was going to, I stopped at his desk, said, "Ron, I've got good news for you." I said, "I'm going to the dentist," and without looking up, he said, "I hope you have 1,000 cavities." So he learned to use humor. And so, I think it's a very healthy way to deal with our own emotions, because our own emotions as parents are very healthy, or as teachers are healthy, and it's important for us to express them. But there are ways of expressing them without attacking the child, and that's what is so good about humor. It shows love, but it also shows, play, and the end result tends to be the child really tends to learn more in that situation than they would when we attack their character.
Yeah. And talk with us, if you would, about the egocentric trap. I think this is one big sticky trap.
Well, there's an amusing story that a psychologist tells, and he had a four-year-old son, and the four-year-old son kept coming into their bed at night, and he kept saying, "You can't come to bed, and whether you have to stay in your own room, And he was going away on a trip, and told his son, "While I'm away, I don't want you to be in your mommy's bed." And then he came back, and he came to the airport, and his wife and son came to meet him, and his son ran across the airport, and at the top of his lungs said, "Daddy, Daddy, no one slept with mommy while you were away." And so, again, I think it was very egocentric at that time to shout out to everybody, "Well, you don't know."
Yeah.
But he was a very good parent, and he recognized that the boy was really proud of having achievements, so he just scooped him up in his arms and said, "Wow, I'm so proud of you." And that's avoiding the egocentric trap, which is seeing it from our point of view. I used to do that when my kids would do something, and I had 8 boys in a movie once, and I couldn't control them and so on. And I was so concerned about how, I would look to their parents, psychologists and psychiatrists and pediatricians and so on. I went out and bought candy and popcorn to keep those mouths busy. But it's that I was concerned about my image rather than concerned about what was best for those kids. So, again, that egocentric trap is when we put our own needs, our own concerns ahead of the child's, and that happens a lot when we want our child to be something that we want them to be rather than what they want themselves to be. And that's one of the greatest tasks for us as parents, I think, is to you know our child as a child and to help him or her to be the best person they can be. If they're a B student, to be a good B student, be rewarded and accepted for that, not forced to try to be forced into an A student or something like that. If they're an artist, then allow them to be an artist, not a lawyer, what you want them to be. Mm-hmm. So that's the hardest part, because we all want our kids to be successful and so on, and sometimes we have particular ambitions that we for them that we would like to see realized, but that may not be their ambition, and that's hard for us. But I think it's that's the egocentric trap, really, is to try to see our child as realizing something of our needs rather than helping them realize their own.
Yeah. David Elkind, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I just am enjoying this conversation, really looking forward to reading that book. And I just thought of a memory I had of something that happened at a park that seemed to kind of fit with the idea of spontaneous play. We were watching some kids, some boys, kind of together in the stand area, and there's a sprinkler area a little ways away. And the boys didn't know each other, but just kind of started gathering around the stand area and creating this elaborate city with rivers and boats, and they kind of had a system where some of them would run over to the sprinklers with buckets and bring it back and pour it in, and all working together. It was just beautiful. Another girl, older, walked by, and they were covered in sand all the way, all over their bodies. They were completely covered, and she said, well, that's gross. And one of the boys said, you might think this is gross, but it's the coolest thing that's ever happened to us. I loved it because I thought of it right away when you talked about spontaneity, because they saw it as something that had happened to them,
right?
Rather than something they had initiated or
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I call it kinship play, and as it, these kids just get together and play because, they're the same age, they're the same size, and so on, and it happens like just as we find people overseas who speak the same language, even if we don't know them, we suddenly begin to talk about things because it's we're strangers and we're friends in a strange land, and in ways children in some ways are strangers in adult land.
Right. Yeah. I think just the appreciation of what a beautiful thing that is when it happens.
Right, and right. Well, that's a lovely example.
For adults to just step back and watch it and say, wow, that's a really great thing.
Yeah, I see. At Christmas, when their grandchildren were unwrapping presents, they were having more fun with the boxes than they were the toys. So same sort of thing, I think.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. It seems that that kinship thing, I find that really fascinating. It seems like as soon as children can walk, maybe even before that, they recognize one another.
Yes, yes. It's well, we have to remember they're little people, and we're big people.
Yeah.
And the world is sized to big people. Doorknobs, everything is for big people. All the cutlery and so on. One of the gifts that Montessori gave was she created child-sized chairs and cutlery and so on. But it's so I think there's a natural tendency to gravitate to someone your own size, and that you can play with and feel as your equal, and that you can relate to in an equal terms of abilities and and language and motor skills and so on. So it's a natural affinity, and it's a wonderful thing to watch. I give examples of my granddaughter in the book, just finding another child in the Boston Garden and playing all kinds of games under a sprinkler, just as the caller described.
Yeah.
Just wonderful. And they didn't know one another, but were playing together like they were old friends.
Yeah. Well, the little people thing makes me think of a wonderful woman who I knew several years ago and lost track of her since. But she had she and her husband had a couple of little girls, and they put the artwork, the pictures and paintings in the girls' room at their sight level.
Right.
And I thought, this is wonderful. I was like, gosh, you stop to think and wow. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Professor Elkind. I was horrified this Christmas season when my kids from Berkeley came in, and my granddaughter was absolutely mesmerized by NPR public broadcasting in the morning, The Virtual Babysitter. What's your opinion on that? I'll hang up and let you answer. Thank you.
I'm not sure what Was there something called actually labeled a virtual babysitter or something?
Well, no, I'm labeling it a virtual babysitter.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
I think
she was just mesmerized looking at this stuff. Yeah. And frankly, I think it's really bad, but you may have a different opinion.
You mean,
there are a lot of programs. There's the Baby Einstein series and so on. And I sat with my granddaughter and watched it. She just listened to some of the visuals in that program. But there are a lot of those things out there. I think that certainly poor working parents and single parents and so on, sometimes, you know, a child watching the television for 10 minutes or 15 or so gives a parent a chance to do some necessary things, and that's okay. I think, you know, it's not going to do that much harm and gets more abused. It's the abuse of it, it's the use of it as a babysitter to when kids are watching it for hours on end, which is the harmful thing. We know the brain is growing very dramatically then. We don't know, and we do know that, you know, that the social input, a touch and interaction with the parent is very important for brain growth. And we're worried, I think, we don't have a lot of data yet, but that kids who watch too much television are not getting that social input and touch input and so on that they need, and are not getting the kind of stimulation. The brain needs a certain kind of Montessori sensory stimulation. The senses need to be, you know, and all senses, the touch, the smell, and so on. I think a little bit of that may be okay, but it really troubles me when children are used, when these things are used as babysitters and kids sit in front of them for hours at end. And it really troubles me when I see parents driving to nursery schools with an SUV and a TV in the back, and instead of using that time to talk and sing and play with their children, the kids are busy watching it. So that's an abuse. I mean, technology is not bad or good. Technology is technology. It's the abuse and misuse of technology which does the harm. And I think that the caller's idea, you know, using it as a babysitter, you have someone, like a young child, watching that for a couple of hours, it could possibly do serious damage. We just don't know yet, but why take the risk? Because we know that the most important thing we can give children at that age is really the interaction that we have with them as individuals, as parents, playing, talking, singing with them. They're not awake that much time, and to waste that time in front of a television screen, I think, is really an abuse of the technology.
Yeah, screen time is not the same as play time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Before we go, I would like you to talk with us a little bit more. You mentioned, you know, in the car or at the breakfast table or whenever the moment presents itself and you have time and, you know, you can talk, you can sing. You're very fond of riddles.
Yes,
and
yes.
Jokes, and maybe you would just let's wrap up here with your thoughts on the great delight of riddles and jokes and how they encourage imagination.
Well, the riddles are really the most popular in school-age children, and now because it reflects a certain level of new mental development, now they recognize that language can be used in two ways at once, and that's really a great discovery, and so they take great pleasure in the riddles, and riddles are really Freud's laughter is a failure of expectancy, and riddles always do that because you get something you don't expect, and so it's funny, and they love that, and it's great because it allows them to, it trains imagination, trains some language skills, and it also is humorous, and looks, you can look at things in different ways and gives them a way to change perspective and see that you can look at things different ways and see them in different ways, and that's a very healthy kind of thing. So when you say, you know, why the tomato blush when she saw the salad dressing,
yeah,
you know, sort of you know, what's the difference between a piano and a fish? Well, you can't tune a fish. You know, so the kids love that kind of stuff. And, you know, what did the boy say to the girl, octopus? And he said, can I hold your hand? So, you know, those are wonderful things. And they are plays on language, which is very healthy for kids. And it trains imagination, mm-hmm, trains fantasy, but it also trains language skills, trains intellect to think different ways and think outside the box and so on. So it has many wonderful opportunities, and I think sometimes starting the day with a riddle with children, have them make their own riddles, is a great way to bring fun into the relationship, and it gives them good intellectual stimulation and as well as a good belly laugh sometimes.
Yeah, all you have to do is get them started, and they're off and running with riddles and knock-knock jokes.
Exactly, the same kind of thing. It's just And those are wonderful and wonderful ways to relate to kids, because then you can relate to them at the same level. You both enjoy them, and it's a kind of egalitarian thing, an equal playing field kind of thing, too, for parents and kids. And so that's another good reason. There's so many ways in which adults are different than kids. But with the riddles, we can all enjoy them, and that sort of makes us more equal. And I think it makes it fun for the kids, because you're not the big authority figure. You're having fun with them.
Yeah, David Alkind, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
I had a great time. It was fun. It was almost like playing.
Yes.
David Alkind has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author most recently of The Power of Play, How Spontaneous Imaginative Activities Lead to Happier, Healthier Children. The book is published by DeCapo Press.